Welcome to the Athenaeum Review, where we talk about the ideas that shape our world. I'm Ben Lima, and our guest today is Vlad Glavianu, who is a leading researcher in the field of the cultural psychology of creativity. He's head of the Department of Psychology at Webster University in Geneva and author of over 100 articles and several books. This year, he received the Berlin Award from the American Psychological Association for outstanding early career contributions to the field of aesthetics, creativity, and the arts. Thank you for being with us today.
Thank you very much for the invitation, Ben.
You mentioned that some of your early research was on the craft of Easter egg decoration in Romania. I wondered if you could tell us how you became interested in researching this and how it developed into your later research.
Yes, it's quite an atypical story for a psychologist. So I'm trained in psychology, but I am very much passionate about creativity, obviously. And while I was reading more and more about the topic, I discovered that there's so many things we know or we think we know about the creative individual, the creative mind, the kind of habits of thinking that people use when they create. And I felt like it's a very disbalanced kind of story. So as a social psychologist and as a cultural psychologist in particular, I always thought that we're missing an element of community. We're missing even the body, the embodiment part. We're missing valuing habits and practice and exercise. So I did this project, which is a bit kind of counterintuitive, just to go and research community level creativity, to understand. Craft was for me just an opportunity to look at these questions. I think there are so many other topics that could be useful in that regard. But for instance, it led me to theorize something that I later on called habitual creativity, which seems like a contradiction in terms in some ways. But it is about how you can't be creative outside of a basis of habitual action that you get then to master, and creativity as mastery. So we often think about creativity in a traditional psychological way as insight. That's why we have this light bulb image and creativity, right, you know, kind right. of appears somewhere in the brain or the mind. But there is another story to creativity. It's much more social, material, and embodied, and very much cultural, which is becoming a masterful practitioner of mm-hmm. something. So anyway, this whole topic led me to not only think about crafts as creative human activities, but also as any type of creativity having a bit of a craft-like characteristic to it. I mean, if you think about it, whether we talk about art and science, design, whatever celebrated fields of creative production, there is always an element of apprenticeships, of the body using different tools and working and habits. And I feel that is the craft-like nature of creativity more broadly. So this is the kind of reflection that encouraged me, yes, to enter that field.
Wow. You're from Romania originally?
Yes.
So were you familiar with this craft practice before deciding to
Absolutely.
Analyze?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, that's one of the big things that I wanted. Well, on the one hand, it's also to show other aspects of living and being from Romania. It is not a uniquely Romanian tradition. Even Easter egg decoration, I mean, it's kind of an international tradition, and a lot of our neighboring countries like Ukraine, you know, they're very famous for the decorated egg. But it was a bit kind of coming from my own cultural background to think about this. Romania has traditionally had, and even today, quite a strong rural kind of culture and rural communities, and it was fascinating for me to go and explore in a bit of an ethnographic study the life and practices of these people. Yes,
I thought this was so interesting, and I wanted to ask you about, I guess, maybe the contrast between traditional crafts and, let's say, the kind of modern industrial environment. For example, I think there are so many people whose jobs, let's say, are very routine and very regimented, and you know, the whole idea of so much modern labor in industry being so alienated. And I wonder what you would say to someone whose job doesn't seem to allow for any creativity, and how is there any way to kind of cope with that, or how do you think about that situation?
It's very interesting. Well, here we're getting deep into what are crafts and what is it to be a craftsman or a craftswoman. And also, the reason I chose craft is because it sits between many, many things. So for instance, the art world, using a term by Howard Becker, also folklore, obviously religion, because it at least the Easter egg decoration, I mean, we call it Easter egg because it's been appropriated by Christianity, right. But it predates it by many, many centuries. I mean, you have decorated stones painted in red, present in tombs and so on. It's such right. a long tradition of decoration and the symbolic meaning of red and other colors.
Yeah.
And then you have the market. And it's very interesting because, again, going back to Howard Becker, he talked about the art, the high art, the whatever, fine arts world. And then there is the world of craft. And historically, you have this counterposition that John Dewey also talked about and kind of contested, that we should not think in these dichotomies of right. the technicians versus the artists.
Right.
Again, you see, it goes back to the way we think of creativity, the body and the practice versus the mind and the idea. And I think we should kind of transcend these dichotomies. But there is the market aspect, and we should not be romantic in thinking, oh, these people live their kind of inner dream and life and
yeah,
look at
yeah.
them, you know. it's a very romanticized view of rural communities and craft. They do have kind of almost an institutionalization of the practice. So when I went to the village Ciocănești, which is in northern Romania, it's a very beautiful village. It's an open-air museum. Houses are all decorated, and it's really fascinating to be there. They have a festival of the decorated egg. They have a museum of the decorated egg. So you can really see the signs of institutionalizing the market, right?
Yeah,
and these people do these eggs, and they do them not only for Easter. It's a kind of a year-long activity. And it's not only for expressing themselves as part of it. Obviously, they take great pleasure in producing this, but it's also for money. They do supplement yeah. their budget with selling the eggs. So I feel like there is always, in every field of creativity, we should take into account the market, the kind of social system around it.
Yeah.
And to go back to your question, because you ended with something a bit more broad about how we can recover or discover these spaces of creativity within yeah. any kind of practice, I think it's going back to the craft-like nature, right, of our activity. There is yeah. a lot of embodied pleasure in working with your hands. I mean,
yes.
craft are called, well, handicrafts or yeah.
yeah.
It's the definition is handmade, basically,
yes.
handmade. And there is beautiful work, I don't remember the name of the author now, but done about craftsmanships of certainty and of risk. And and a lot of the mechanical way of working gives us this complete certainty that things would go well. You know,
yeah.
the vase is produced mechanically, so there will always be the vase of the same kind. And craft opens you up to uncertainty and risk. And there is a bit of a pleasure in our human experience to go through moments when we don't know if things will come out correctly, you know.
Yeah.
So kind of recovering this, exposing ourselves to uncertainty, working
yeah.
with our hands, using our bodies more and not only our minds. I think these could be interesting ways to yeah create spaces for creativity.
Yeah, yeah. I also, the other kind of modern example that I thought of was, you know, the so-called culture industry. And I'm just thinking of the when I watched a Pixar animated movie and the credits at the end, there must have been hundreds or thousands of people who are all working on this one single kind of creative project, but in a very organized and, you know, disciplined way as part of this enormous organization. And I and not just movies, but, you know, television or any of these kind of culture industry products. Do you analyze these types of things at all in your work, the kind of like big productions?
So until now, I've worked with more marginal spaces
yeah.
and communities.
Yeah, yeah.
So one of the fascinations with craft is that it's a bit of an outsider art. It's decorative art. It's folk art. It's a bit. Although, again, going back, you notice both how the field of crafts became more institutionalized and how artists, fine artists, and celebrated artists, they want to go back to being more craftsmen in so many ways.
I mean,
they want to relinquish this intentionality and go back to accidents and to. So it's very, very interesting as a general movement. I didn't study I was part of a study with film script writers in France, and I was part of a team analyzing the data on that. And what strikes me, because I really go from a place of collaborative creativity and co-creation, is the difference between the reality of this practice, which is very much shared and everyone contributes, as you say, and the way we understand it and celebrate it in society, which is very much
right.
pointing to the director or often the actor.
Yes, yeah.
The work of these people is almost invisible. And part of that paper and part of the interviews we had with scriptwriters was telling of the frustration of not being recognized, of being, yeah, kind of absent from their own production.
Yeah.
And I feel like here we go to a theme that is very dear to me. I sometimes talk about the we paradigm of creativity, contrasting
yeah.
it with the he paradigm of the genius and the I paradigm of creative potential. And the we paradigm in which we kind of live nowadays is gaining more and more currency. It hasn't been this way historically, but nowadays we understand that, yeah, creativity is a collaborative endeavor first and foremost. It's not really reflected in the way we study creativity and we celebrate it in society. Many awards are still very much individual based. There is so much work to do to recover and to celebrate the network or the group when it comes to creativity. If you think even at the basic of the basic example of sculptures and like the way we depict famous people, and it's often that one person, right? That's a traditional way of doing sculptures and celebrating. So there are so many things in society that pull us towards the individual and, and less the group, less the context. And I feel like even for these industries, I mean, one of the big problems is not only not recognition, but also this other ideology of creativity, which is the I paradigm. Everyone has creative potential. And then because it's your potential as an individual, you also have the responsibility for your own creativity. You're the one who is the center of your own creativity. You should cultivate it. If you fail, you are the one who's been less creative, right? So the we paradigm, if we really kind of took on this collaborative nature of creativity, it would make creativity a shared responsibility in some ways. Instead of thinking always about, even in classrooms, in schools, how do we make this child more creative? We would think, how do we make a culture for creativity within the classroom? You know, so it's really a revolution that is in the making. And as always, there is always a lag, you know, in different parts of society and the way we think. But I think, you know, technology and where things are going, it's pushing us more and more towards that. I'm not trying to be over optimistic because it also has many pitfalls, but I feel like there is a big societal change, and you see that in academic work across different disciplines. User innovation, the prod user, producer and user, I mean, it's a huge wave of recognizing that more.
I wanted to ask you also, I think here in America, specifically with American culture, there's such a strong idea of individualism and this idea that to be a true individual or creative individual involves going against society and against the mainstream. And I was curious, in different cultures, maybe if you know certain cultures are more collective or more individualistic, these whether these ideas vary from place to place in different cultures.
Absolutely. I mean, I will just start by problematizing a little bit what the notion of the American culture is, because, you know, I'm a sociocultural or cultural psychologist, which is a bit different than cross-cultural psychologists, which work very much, they take the national unit as a unit of culture. And I think it's a very handy heuristic, obviously, you know, if they have boundaries around and borders, probably there is something similar happening in that space. But then you have such complexity in each and every culture. I mean, obviously, we can agree, especially with a country so big as America, with so many influences and differences within it, probably there are many pockets and subcultures. But indeed, there is a culture. There is such a thing. Right. And dominant culture appears in commercials. And if you look at the way brands, you know, put again, you are the one who needs to do it, to be in front, to achieve. And then movies and then the messages we get from there. So there is such thing as dominant culture. And then obviously the individualistic kind of drive is predominant. It has some good sides in the sense that it tries to democratize creativity. Everyone could do it. Right. It tries to make it flexible and you can educate yourself and do more. But it also has this huge risk of, as I mentioned before, if you fail, it is kind of on you, because creativity was something you are responsible for. It's your quality. And that's why you have such high rates of burnout in creative industries and people who feel such pressure. If I don't achieve, you know, if I'm not creative, what will I do? So in other cultures, in other cultural spaces, and you have, people would refer to more collectivistic culture, you have a very different view of creativity, because the self is seen very, very differently. So when the self is not this unitary, cohesive kind of, we cherish a lot, and I say we because I grew up in Romania, but I studied in the UK, I worked in Denmark, now in Switzerland. So I know this, I'm immersed into it. I find it in myself. I mean, it's nice that we talk about it, but then unconsciously we do these kind of things, right? And there is such a glorification of the individual self. I mean, this is our most prized possession. It's defending who we are and our privacy and space and all of that. And then if you shift that, and if you think, I'm multiple, I am mobile, I depend, myself, I cannot define myself outside of connecting with others, creativity becomes much more about continuity rather than rupture, about adaptation and evolution rather than revolution. And in many ways, the project we just started talking about, the craft one, it's very much an Eastern conception of creativity that I kind of promote in my work. I think what I did might be quite out there for colleagues working in a Western context. How do you even put together Easter eggs and creativity? Uh-huh. But it would make perfect sense for people, you know, Southeast Asia or other places where tradition is the way creativity expresses itself. You know, everything is reworking tradition and So I think there are different conceptions. I think that they're much more multiple even than East and West. I mean, look at the Global South, look at other perspectives as well. And I think the challenge is, how do we recover them? How do we integrate them? How do we even become aware of them? It's fine to say, oh, you might have a different way of thinking, but as long as we use the same research methods and the same criteria and the same definition of creativity worldwide, we will never let these differences come to the surface. Yeah. And I would really encourage, you know, anyone who can produce or reflect on a more indigenous kind of bottom-up, local, grassroots type of psychology of creativity to do speak about that. And there are some colleagues who do that. You know, they think of the Indian kind of culture and the way they would see creativity, but it's still kind of muted. So I would appreciate more diversity in the way we think. I think it would be a great benefit.
Yeah, definitely. Can I just, you mentioned having gone from Romania to the UK to Denmark to Switzerland. I was curious whether, did your experience kind of observing these different communities, did that give you insights? It must have given you some insight into the different cultures. Can you say a little more about that?
I'm sure it did. You know, I was studying culture. I was going to different cultures. Some of them, especially, I mean, I think in a way the biggest contrast is between Romania, which is Eastern Europe, kind of a bit Balkan culture, and the rest, the three others. Although there is such a difference again between Denmark, which is very much a welfare state society, and the Scandinavian model, and then what you see in the UK, and even in Switzerland. I never really got to, you see, I also, just to take you on a bit of a detour, I also do like hobby, you know, I try to write some fantasy and things. I paint, but I never use my own models of creativity when I paint. I never sit and think, oh, you know what I did here. So it's kind of a little bit what happens with culture. So I teach actually even a course on communication and culture, but I never really sat to really reflect of my own trajectory in that term, but I'm in those terms. But I'm pretty sure that, of course, these things accumulate. And my own view of creativity is that the different positions in the world you occupy, including being in different countries, equip you, furnish you with new perspectives on reality. So diversity of experience means more mental flexibility. It means that when I come to the US, I can think, oh, they do it differently in Denmark, but also in the UK, but just in a different way, Denmark versus UK. So all of that gives you a broader perspective, I would hope. Yeah. And I think it does make you reflect on culture. Sadly, we often think of culture when we bump into it. So when you experience culture shock, you're like, oh, culture exists. Look at that, you know.
We were talking about tipping.
I don't know when and how and how much, but and then you see it. It's so obvious. But there's so many other insidious kind of subconscious ways in which culture appears that are absolutely fascinating. So we talk about Western culture in the US and UK and Switzerland, Denmark, where they're all in a bundle, but they're so very different. And I see that in the way the physical surrounding is made. So for instance, I'm very used in Europe to walking a lot, and I use only public transport and so on. And I was trying to cross the street here. There was no crossing, because if you don't have a car, you almost can't get to the other side. So all of this is, you know, there's the physical, but then it reflects something of the psychological and the social. And it's not a matter of better or worse, it's just a matter of how things are. It's absolutely fascinating.
So in some of your in your talk and your writing, you mentioned how it can be very useful to look back at the history of psychology and before and consider some of these ideas that might have been forgotten. And so I wanted to ask about Well, basically about the idea of the biological aspect of creativity. So
Yes.
whether in that kind of Freud and these unconscious drives, or even, for example, in evolutionary psychology, these kind of animal instincts, just generally, is the biological basis important for how you understand?
This is such a good question. And I rarely get to be asked this question in many ways, because I think it's partially because people know that I study the sociocultural dynamic, but
right.
Definitely, we cannot forget about biology. We cannot forget
right.
about the brain. I personally, and this is another little side conversation, but I think it's important. We are kind of recording this,
yeah.
and I will stand by this statement I'm going to make. The neuroscience of creativity is a bit misleading for me. So,
yeah.
neuroscience, absolutely important. You can't do anything without a brain. Absolutely, you can't create. That's for
yeah.
sure. But the notion of creativity is a social construction. It's a social label. You can confirm that by looking at what was judged creative 2 decades ago, a century ago, and what will be in the future creative. It will be very different. Okay,
yeah, yeah.
It's very different, as we just had this conversation about, you know, the East and the West. So clearly, the notion of creativity is socially constructed. The
yeah.
value, the meaning of it. Now, it does reflect a real phenomenon, and you can call it in different ways. And some people talk about improvisation, imagination, innovation, creativity, and so on and so forth. But there is something people do, and that kind of doing historically has been going on for, as you said, in evolutionary psychology for, you know, millennia and so on. And it's important to go back to what is being done.
Yeah.
But at the same time, so ideation obviously relates to the brain and it has a biological support, but creativity is very much, if you really want to study creativity, you need to take society into account. There is no creativity that happens outside of society, outside
yeah.
of social conventions and using the label of creativity. So by saying that, I'm not trying to say some animals could not act in a creative-like manner,
right.
but you need a society to engage in the phenomenon called creativity. I hope
yeah.
it kind of makes sense. So
yeah.
you can attribute creativity to animals and to whatever, but you need to live within a society. Now, having said that, I think it's very interesting to work in an inclusive manner and kind of develop multidisciplinary approaches that can accommodate and include the biological and the sociocultural, because these are not an either or. I
yeah.
think a big harm has been done by this huge debate on nature versus nurture. It's
right.
versus why. So they actually collaborate. I mean, a lot of sociocultural theory is precisely about how there is a co-evolution between our biological kind of capabilities and
yeah.
what culture fosters and provides us. So we develop culture in line in many ways with our biological equipment and possibilities, and culture also comes back in, I mean, the very simple example using glasses and so on, technology to expand our biological and innate whatever abilities. So looking at this dynamic would be much more interesting for me, and it would also reveal what some people obviously are talking about with the evolutionary kind of perspectives, the fact that culture always is a bit of a step ahead. I mean, look at all the technologies today that take us to places that are quite unknown for our biological evolutionary past. So
yeah.
I'm not an expert in this area, so don't quote me on this, but I do know that a lot of our psychology, I mean, as a social psychologist, you see that we operate very well at an interpersonal level where we're, you know, quite well equipped, and babies from early on reading emotion, understanding the mental states of others. We're really, this is distinguishing kind of the
yeah.
human species. But then how do you operate at the level of the nation, right?
Yeah.
The media constructs images of what nations are. We have today so many, you know, debates about the migration crisis in Europe, in the US, and so on. And these big representations of these other big groups coming in and kind of, you know, whatever they do, they're contaminating, they're attacking, they're... All of this is challenging our biological capabilities, because we think very well in terms of us and them and all of that.
Yeah.
But when you expand the scale, the nation is not a person, but we operate with this almost like assumption, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
So what I'm trying to say, I guess, is that there is an interesting tension between the biological capabilities we have and where culture is taking us nowadays. And you
yeah.
see that very well with technology.
Yeah.
Often technology is going way beyond where we could be.
Yeah.
It's impacting the way we think. And we later on get to know, oh my God, look what happened after we went all this way. You know, I mean, all the ethical concerns, everything is coming up nowadays.
Yeah.
It's part of this fast movement. So I think there is something very interesting for creativity researchers there to study this junction and tension, as well as the collaboration. I started by saying, obviously, that there is a lot of co-development, but there is also a bit of tension. So I think this would be a very interesting question for trying to incorporate both sides.
Yes, that makes a lot of sense. You mentioned briefly a couple of projects about the idea of wonder and about the idea of the possible. Could I just ask you to tell us a little about your upcoming projects?
Excellent. Perfect. I'm always looking forward to talking about this project. So I'm the reason I got interested in creativity is not for the notion of creativity itself. Actually, in my own community of scholars, which is cultural psychology, people don't talk about creativity a lot. They try to avoid it. They sometimes talk about imagination. Imagination is quite popular. And it's because of the historical, ideological roots of the term. Creativity has been taken over by a bit of a neoliberal individualistic consumerist approach in which, why do we talk about creativity? Because we need creativity as an engine of producing and consuming. And then that's the whole value. And that's why people invest in it. So it's not all bad. But in some communities of scholarship, this word is already lost. You know, don't talk about creativity. It cannot be saved. It's individualistic. And no, I'm of the opinion that we should talk about creativity. We should take it as an umbrella term because, for instance, I'm very interested in issues of emergence, issues of agency, of empowerment, and so on. But I use the word creativity. And I think it makes sense because there is a lot of scholarship done that could be relevant to all of these other things. And that's when I get to my actual interest of late and my new direction, which is the possible. I mean, the notion of the possible is very complex and we can talk hours just about the possible. Yeah. But I'm going to summarize it by saying that because we live in cultural worlds, we live not only in the present and the here and now, but we live in many other mental and physical spaces going towards the future, the past, and what is possible. And whenever we talk to someone or see a certain reality, we don't only see that reality in front of us, but we mentally explore alternatives, counterfactuals, we anticipate. That is what makes us human in many ways. So I think that is extremely powerful. And my current work is trying to explore that creativity and imagination and other similar processes as a way of engaging with the possible and as a way of cultivating the possible in our lives. How, and this is what's, you know, drives society forward, either at the level of individual development, you see children doing that and as they grow and so on, and you look at the level of arts and sciences and different domains, it's always a strive towards what is not yet here, what could be done, what is still possible, you know?
Yeah.
Vygotsky had a beautiful kind of zone of proximal development notion here of how in collaboration with others, you expand what you could think and do on your own.
Yeah.
So I feel like there is such a rich, fertile ground there that has beautiful like theoretical roots and important practical consequences. And the notion of wonder and wondering comes exactly into this is an experience, a very human experience that is exactly the experience you get when the field of the possible opens up in front of you. So we live our lives in more or less conventional, more or less habitual, sometimes a bit pre-reflexive ways. And then something happens, usually a new perspective comes up on something that, you know, you never thought could be seen in a different way.
Yeah.
And your mind kind of opens up, the space of the possible opens up, and you think, wow, if a water bottle is both a container, but it's also, you know, it has a weight and I can use it as a hammer if I need to hammer something, what else can a water bottle be? You know, that process of wondering has a huge developmental value, and it really makes the bridge between what I've been saying about the possible and creativity. Wonder is really at the root of a lot of creative actions and expressions. I'm not going to say that wonder equals creativity. I think you have moments in the creative process or types of creativity where you wonder a bit less per se, but there is always a component of that because creativity, even when it starts in accident, at some point it needs to reflect on what has happened. And that's when the possible comes in and then you play with, you toy with alternatives and so on. So this is really my kind of next step. I've written a bit about that, but I'm more and more kind of taking in nowadays the field is enormous and expanding. You have anticipation studies, you have people looking at the future, you have counterfactual thinking, you have probabilistic thinking, you have possibility thinking. I mean, it's amazing, the area is very rich. but it comes from different disciplines, different histories. So yeah. it really, I mean, the process of making sense of that, because, yeah, you know, yeah. you can put two ideas together, but sometimes they can't really sit together very well. So I'm kind yeah. of exploring what sits with what in building a little framework of it.
So genuinely interdisciplinary project.
Yeah, that is the best and the yeah. most difficult, because I feel like people taking interdisciplinarity as a, I call it the onion model of interdisciplinarity. Right. You have a layer and then you have another layer and another one. It looks kind of beautiful together, but it's the cross-sectionality, it's cutting through the onion that makes interdisciplinarity. It's right. not just that you are at a certain level and you think, oh, other people are doing another level and others are doing another, so we're all kind of knowing of each other. No, you in your own project need yeah. to cut through the levels and ask questions that make sense for different levels. So yeah. even as a creativity researcher, I could be very well interested in the mind and cognitive stuff. Absolutely. I mean, I'm not denying the individual mind. I'm not denying the role of cognition. The brain as well, you know, it yeah. has to be there. But how would it be to ask your question about the individual in view of and in relation with the fact that we're also social beings, cultural beings, and biological beings?
Yeah.
How would you formulate that question? So that's true multidisciplinarity for me.
Yeah. Slicing the onion, that's
exactly. Without crying, metaphor. I don't yeah. know. Sometimes crying. You have to.
Yeah. Sometimes you have to cry. That's fantastic. This is the Athenaeum Review, where we talk about the ideas that shape our world. Vlad Glavianu's visit to UT Dallas was made possible by the Center for Values in Medicine, Science, and Technology. The Athenaeum Review is produced by Creative Disturbance and the UT Dallas School of Arts and Humanities. Find out more at creativedisturbance.org.